Chapter 7. The Lost is Found. I will go and see him. And so the refractory cow heard the voice of her calf when the crafty farmer brought it to the field that was to be ploughed, so that the cow would be contented there. And the cow yielded her neck to the yoke and ploughed. Hard enough it was for her still, with her considerable dislike of the field, which she thought of as a death acre. Jacob's deliberate and declared intention was not easier to him than submission was to the cow. Indeed, he was glad that at least he had time to think it over. Actually, to carry it out, to part from all that was his by ingrained habit, to transport the tribe, bag and baggage, to the lowland, that took much time. And by the same token, it gave him time. The Bene Yisrael were not the people to take literally Pharaoh's words not to regard their stuff, for that they should be provided with all in the land of Goshen, and they were simply to leave everything where it was. Not to regard their stuff, that meant at most not to take everything they had, which was impossible anyhow. Not all their tools and equipment, and not all the cattle and fowl. On the other hand, it certainly did not mean that they were to travel light and leave everything behind for the first comer. They sold off quantities of goods, and certainly not in unseemly haste, or without very stiff bargaining. But Jacob let them go ahead and sell, which proves that he kept to his resolve in its main lines, although the way he talked about it might be open to various interpretations. "I will go down thither and see him," he would say. That might mean, "I will visit him to see his face before I die, and then come back." But it was clear to all of them, even to Jacob himself, that it really could not mean that. If it had been a matter of just a visit to behold his face, then certainly it would be his high and mightiness Joseph who owed his little father the visit in order to spare him the great inconvenience of a journey to Mizraim. But on the other hand, such a thought ran counter to the motif of the sending after, and Jacob perfectly understood that the stars in their courses had so ruled in the matter. Joseph had not been separated and snatched away for that. Jacob's face had not to that end been swollen with weeping, only in order that they should now visit each other. No, the high purpose was that Joseph should have Israel come after him, and Jacob was far too much of an expert in God-knowledge not to know that the snatching away of the lovely one, his magnification down below, the obstinate famine which had driven the brothers down to Egypt, that all these were arrangements in a comprehensive plan, to ignore which would have been the crassest stupidity. One might find Jacob self-centered and arrogant in that a calamity like the present prolonged drought, so widespread, affecting so many people and causing such wholesale economic changes, was seen by him merely in the light of a plan for the furtherance of his own tribal history. Quite obviously it was his idea that where he and his house were in question, the rest of the world would have to like it or lump it. But arrogance and egoism are only negative words for a highly positive and fruitful attitude which we might call by the more sympathetic name of piety. There are probably no virtues which cannot be called by unsympathetic names, none without inward contradictions, such as, in the present case, humility and arrogance. Piety is the subjectivation of the outer world, its concentration upon the self and its salvation. Without the conviction, exaggerated to the point of offensiveness, of God's especial, yes, all-embracing concern, without the fixation of the self and its salvation in the very center of all things, there is no piety. Piety, in short, is the name we give to that great virtue. Its opposite is the low esteem of the self and its relegation to the unimportant periphery, out of which nothing good can come. He who does not take himself seriously is soon lost. But he who thinks of himself as Abram did when he resolved that he, and in him, man, might serve only the highest, he does, of course, behave presumptuously, but this presumption will be a blessing to many. For here is manifest the connection between the dignity of the self and the dignity of humanity. The claim of the human ego to central importance was the precondition for the discovery of God. And only together with the consequence of the utter destruction of a humanity which does not take itself seriously can both discoveries be lost sight of again. But we must go on from here, for subjectivation does not mean subjection, nor esteem of self, disesteem of others. It does not mean isolation, or a callous disregard of the general, the exterior, and superpersonal, in short, of all that reaches beyond the self. On the contrary, it therein solemnly recognizes itself. In other words, if piety is the being penetrated with the importance of the self, then worship is piety's extension and assimilation into the eternalness of being, which returns in it and wherein it recognizes itself. That is to depart from all singleness and limitation, yet with no violence to its own dignity, which it even enhances to the point of consecration. In such a light, then, we may consider Jacob's mood at this time of the breakup, and we can scarcely think of it as more solemn than it actually was. He was about to carry out quite literally what he had dreamed of at the peak of his affliction and feverishly prattled in Eliezer's ear. He was going down to his dead son in the underworld. That was a cosmic procedure. And where the ego opens its borders to the cosmic and loses itself therein, even until its own identity is blurred, can there be any thought of narrowness or isolation? The very thought of the breakup was full of contrary tending factors, the factor of abiding, the factor of the return. They elevated the moment above and beyond the episodic and atomic. Jacob the Greybeard was Jacob the youth again, he who, after the deception that put things right, had departed from Beersheba to Naharaim. He was Jacob, the man who with wives and flocks had got free from Haran after a stay of 25 years. But he was not only Jacob, the man in whose life spiral the breakup repeated itself. He was also Isaac, who went to Gerar, to Abimelech in the land of the Philistines. Again and still further back, he was seeing repeat itself the primeval breakup, Abram the wanderer's exodus from Ur of the Chaldees. And even that was not the first form, but only the earthly reflection and imitation of a celestial wandering, the wandering of the moon, who took her way and freed herself from one station to the next, Bel-Haran, the Lord of the Way. But Abram, the first earthly wanderer, had made pause at Haran. So it was plain that Beersheba was to represent it, and that Jacob would there make his first moon station. He took comfort in the thought of Abram, how during a famine he too had gone to Egypt to dwell there as a stranger. And Jacob had need of comfort. True, he was looking forward to a joy so keen that it was almost pain. After that he might depart in peace, since nothing to compare with it remained to look for. True, the migration to Egypt, there by Pharaoh's consent to pasture on fat land, was an enviable lot, and so esteemed by many. But when all was said and done, the decision was hard for Jacob. It was hard for him to adapt himself to God's command to void the land of his fathers and exchange it for the offensive land of the animal gods, the land of mud, the land of the children of Ham. He had settled in the land whither Abram had wandered, had done it provisionally, as it were, and like his forefathers, had always been half a stranger there. Still, he had thought to die as they had in this spot. He had always considered to refer to this land where he was born and where his dead rested, the prophecy made to Abram that his seed would be strange in the land. But now it turned out that the prophecy, which, not for nothing, was bound up with thoughts of terror and great darkness, actually pointed to the land whither he was now going, to Mizraim, the Egyptian house of bondage. That, we know, had always been Jacob's mistrustful name for the strictly administered land down south. Certainly he had never contemplated its becoming a house of bondage for his own seed, as now became painfully clear to him. His leave-taking was burdened with the insight that God's pronouncement, "And they shall afflict them 400 years," referred to the country whither he was going. It was, in all probability, the forced labor of many generations to which he was leading his people. The plan of salvation might be altogether good, or good and bad might be wholly cancelled out in the great concept of destiny and the future. But notwithstanding all that, this was uncontestably a break-up fraught with destiny, to which Jacob now committed himself in God, and as such he felt it. Yes, they were going to the land of tombs, and that was bad enough. But actually, it was the tombs he was leaving behind that he thought of with the keenest pain. Rachel's wayside grave, and Machpelah, the double hollow which Abram had bought as a burial place with the field it stood in from Ephron the Hittite for 400 silver shekels by weight, according to custom. Israel, like all shepherds, was free-footed. Still, he did possess that much real estate, the field with the cave, and his it should remain. The emigrants disposed of many movables, but just this immovable, the field with the tomb, that was inalienable. To Jacob, it was the guarantee of his return. For however many generations were to rot in Egypt's soil while his house increased, he was resolved to lay it upon God and man that when the remnant of his own days was lived out, he himself was to be brought back to the permanent home which he, the shepherd and wanderer, possessed on earth, that he might lie where lay his father and the mothers of his sons, all save only the beloved and untimely cut off, who lay by the wayside, mother of his darling taken hence, who summoned him now. So it was good that Jacob had time to consider his departure down thither to the snatched one, for it was a heavy task, this of understanding God's purposes in the strange destiny of the set-apart darling. Jacob's conclusion on this subject can best be heard from himself. When he spoke of Joseph now, he spoke of him not otherwise than as his lordship, my son. I intend, he would say, to travel down to his lordship, my son, in Egypt. He holds high office there. People to whom he said that probably smiled behind the old man's back and made merry over paternal vanity. They did not know how much deadly serious effort after objectivity, how much renunciation and stern resolve lay behind Jacob's turn of phrase. 70 of them. The flowery spring had become late summer before Israel had his affairs wound up and the train got under way from the grove of Mamre by Hebron. Beersheba was their nearest goal, and some days of ceremonial sojourn there were to be spent in this border place where Jacob and his father were born and where the resolute mother, Rebekah, had once readied the thief of the blessing for the journey into Mesopotamia. Jacob departed from his own place and set forth with flocks and possessions, with sons and sons' sons, with daughters and daughters' sons, or, as the story also says, with their little ones and their wives, a limited reckoning, since by wives was meant the wives of the sons, and by daughters the same thing, with addition of the daughters of the sons, for instance, the singing Sirah. They left 70 strong, that is, they reckoned themselves 70, but it was not by actual count, merely a feeling of a count, a sort of mental conclusion in which there prevailed that lunar degree of exactness of which we well know that it was not like our own, yet entirely right and justifiable in its time and place. 70 was the number of the peoples of the earth listed in the tables of God. Consequently, nothing in black and white was required in order to prove that 70 was the number of descendants from forefathers' loins. But when it came to Jacob's loins, surely the wives of the sons ought not to have been counted in, and accordingly they were not. For where there is no counting at all, there can be no counting in. The sum arrived at was not a matter of counting at all, resting as it did on a foregone conclusion. Thus, it is idle to ask what was counted and what not. We do not even know whether Jacob himself was one of the 70, or whether they reckoned him separately as the 71st. We must be content to think that the age permitted both possibilities at the same time. Much later, for instance, a descendant of Judah, or more precisely, of his son Perez, with whom Tamar had deliberately presented him, this descendant, a man named Isaiah, had 7 sons, and a youngest son who tended the sheep, upon whom the horn of anointing was lifted up. What does this "and" mean? Was he included as the youngest of 7? Or did Isaiah have 8 sons? The former is more likely, for it is much finer and more orthodox to have 7 sons than 8. But it is more than likely, in fact it is certain, that the figure 7, as the number of Isaiah's sons, did not change to 8 when the youngest came along, and that the youngest succeeded in being included in the 7, even though he was actually 1 over the count. And once there was another man who had full 70 sons, for he had many wives. 1 son of these mothers killed all his brothers, the whole 70 sons on one same stone. By our prosaic reckoning, he can only, being their brother, have killed 69, or rather 68, since another brother, whose name is given, Jotham, remained alive. The statement is hard to swallow. Yet here, 1 of 70 did kill all 70, and yet left himself and another brother alive. A striking and instructive instance of counting in and not counting in at the same time. Jacob, then, actually was the 71st among the 70 wanderers, insofar as this figure itself can stand the light of day, for in prosaic truth, the number was less rather than more. A fresh contradiction, but unfortunately an unavoidable one. Jacob, the father, was the 70th and not the 71st, on the basis of the fact that the males of the seed came to 69. However, it did so by including Joseph, who was in Egypt, and his 2 sons, who were even born there. These 3 males of the stock were certainly not in the train that went down. Accordingly, we must subtract them, even although they belong to the figure 70. Again, even this deduction leaves too many, for the figure 70 reckoned in a number of souls as yet unborn. We might let pass the case of Jochebed, a daughter of Levi, whose mother was already heavy with her at the time of the journey, she being born between the walls, probably the walls of the border fortress on their entry into Egypt. But there is more to it than that, for the sum total counts in grandchildren who are neither born nor begot, not present, but only foreseen. They came to Egypt, as pious scholars put it, in lumbus patrum, and took part in the journey only in a metaphysical sense. So much for the necessary subtractions. But there are equally compelling reasons for increasing the sum total. The male seed of Jacob came to that sum by itself. But if, or rather since, all his immediate descendants must be counted in, then, if certainly not the sons' wives, yet their daughters must be included. For example, Sarah, quite decidedly, to mention only one. It would be entirely wrong not to count the little maid who brought the good news about Joseph. Her fame was great in Israel, and there was never any doubt about the fulfillment of the blessing which Jacob had gratefully conferred on her, that she should not taste death, but go up living into heaven. Nobody, in fact, knows when she died. Her life story has every appearance of continuing on and on. There is the tale that generations later, the man Moses, going about hunting for Joseph's grave, had the spot in the middle of the Nile pointed out to him by Sarah. Vastly later than that, even, she seems to have pursued her existence among the people of Abram under the name of the Wise Woman. However that may be, whether it was the same Sarah all the time, or whether other little maids assumed the name and nature of the first little herald and harbinger, in any event, she must be included. No objecting voice will be raised, no matter how her inclusion affects the count. But we cannot be so thoroughgoing about the wives of the sons. In other words, the mothers of Jacob's grandchildren. The word mothers is better than wives in this connection, on account of Tamar, who, conformably to the whither thou goest, I will go, made one in the train with her 2 stout Judah sons. Mostly she went on foot, leaning on a long staff, taking for a woman very long strides, tall and dark, with round nostrils and proud mouth, and that strange, distant-dwelling look of hers. This resolute woman, who would not at any price be counted out, should she not be counted in? As for her 2 husbands, Ur and Onan, they could not be counted, neither by moon nor by daylight reckoning, for they were dead. And even if Israel counted unborn souls, surely he did not count dead ones. Shelah, on the other hand, the husband whom she did not get, but whom she no longer needed, since she had given him 2 fine stout half-brothers, went along, being one among Leah's 32 grandchildren.